The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We've got the Best of the Book Nook coming up for you this morning, and today we're going to go into our archive and pull out an interview I did 17 years ago with Bill Bryson. He came out to the studios here in Yellow Springs and did an interview for his travel book about Australia. That book is called In a Sunburned Country. It's a great travel book. It's also a wonderful work of humor. Bill Bryson is a unique personality, and we're going to bring you that personality in the Best of the Book Nook right after NPR News. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. We've been going into our Book Nook archive and pulling out some goodies from the past. And back in 2000, the writer Bill Bryson came out to Yellow Springs. He was on book tour for his travel book about going to Australia. It was called In a Sunburned Country. He came out here, and he had been on the program before. We'd done a phone interview a few years previously, and he didn't remember doing that. That's clear. As you listen to this interview, he doesn't recall knowing me or having talked to me before. And that was good because it gave me the element of surprise. I had a big surprise for Bill Bryson on this program. And you're going to hear it as it was recorded back in 2000 during this Best of the Book Nook interview. Previously, before he put out In a Sunburned Country, he published a book called A Walk in the Woods. That was the book that put him on the map, so to speak, right in the middle of the Appalachian Trail, if you've read that book or seen the film adaptation with Robert Redford and Nick Nolte. Of course, in the movie, the characters are a lot older. When Bill Bryson hiked the Appalachian Trail with his friend Stephen Katz, they were young men. Bill Bryson recently turned 65. He's living in England, kind of resting on his laurels. He hasn't put out a book for a couple of years. But back in 2000, when we recorded this interview, he was on top of the world. A Walk in the Woods had sold millions of copies. And we talked to him about that and the book that he just put out called In a Sunburned Country. Let's listen now to the Best of the Book Nook. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And it's my pleasure to have on the program today a guy who really gets around. His name is Bill Bryson. His new book is called In a Sunburned Country. Welcome to Antioch College in Yellow Springs.
Thank you very much. I was just thinking earlier, this is my second visit to Antioch. The first one was almost exactly 30 years ago. We stopped off here. I was going to Florida from Des Moines for a spring break when I was in college. One of the guys I was traveling down there with had been at Antioch for a couple of years and then dropped out, transferred to another college. So we stopped off here to see some of his old friends. So it's nice to be back.
30 years ago, those were, what would they say, halcyon days?
Halcyon days. I don't know what Antioch is like now, but there was certainly a certain hippiness to it then. It was very, very attractive. It was a nice place. It was a spring, too, so it was, the world was in bloom, and it was a really nice time to be here.
Well, we hear a lot of stories of those days. Richie Furay, who went on to create the band Poco, grew up just down the road, grew up here in Yellow Springs, and John Hammond went to school here, Jorma Kaukonen went to school here, so I guess things were happening.
Yeah. No, it was a great time everywhere. This was like 1971. So it was in such an interesting era. Still all the anti-war stuff and the civil rights movement was just kind of coming to a conclusion, and the world seemed a lot more lively and engaged than. We live in this very passive age now. I miss it myself. I miss being young, too, of course.
You also lament in the new book, In a Sunburned Country, the fact that you can go really far away to a place like, say, Alice Springs, Australia, and look out your window, and there's a Kmart.
Yeah. I mean, I have traveled enough that I shouldn't be stunned when that sort of thing happens. But Alice Springs, it was a blow. I mean, because it is so, to get to Alice Springs, particularly by car, as I was getting there, you've really got to want to get there. I mean, it's 1,000 miles from Darwin, across the emptiest desert you have ever seen in your whole life. Really, as you're driving down this 1,000 miles to two-lane highway, to left and right, it can be another 1,000 miles till you came to another piece of highway. So you're really in the middle of nowhere. And as it happened, I arrived in Alice Springs late in the afternoon, sort of dusk, and checked into a motel in the middle of town, went up to my room, and there was a, sort of wall-to-wall windows, and I threw back the curtains, and there exactly bang opposite was a Kmart. And my heart sank, because, you don't travel halfway around the world to see a Kmart. No matter how dedicated a shopper you are, it's just the last thing you want to see in the middle of the Australian outback. And that was a real stunner. I mean, to realize that it wasn't as if it was even a sort of Australian Kmart. It was just exactly the same plans. They had probably shipped it out in pieces and assembled it there. So it was a real disappointment. Yeah.
My guest is Bill Bryson. His new book is In a Sunburned Country, as opposed to A Sunburnt Country. And you got a little sunburnt yourself on this book.
I did.
You have written a number of books, and one in particular, I think it was Lost Continent.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one about traveling in the U.S.?
That is.
Okay.
It is.
It's been pointed out that you were somewhat caustic in that book. Have you mellowed a little bit over the years?
I think I have. There's no question that as I've gotten older, I have become more magnanimous and less irate about the things that are wrong in the world. I think that happens to all of us. So I have matured a good deal, I think. If I did a similar trip around the United States now, there would still be plenty that I would be critical of, but I might not get on quite such a high horse about a lot of it. And then the Australia book is really a very kindly book, because I got there and I just liked it. I mean, I really, really liked everything about the country. There's a great deal to admire in it. I mean, just the way it's organized and the way it's run and the way it operates. It's a pretty good, pretty admirable society. They do a lot of things very well. A lot of things better than us, has to be said, I think, in terms of things like just a dedication to public transportation and a sense of needing to provide universal health care and that kind of thing. It's a slightly more enlightened society than we tend to be. But also it's just a very, very attractive place. I mean, very nice people, extremely helpful, cold beer, good coffee, all the things, great climate, wonderful beaches, everything that you could possibly desire in a country is there, except, convenience. It's a long way away. And it's small. I mean, it has a problem that there's only 18 million people, so they do have a problem that a great deal of their culture has to be imported, has to be borrowed from elsewhere. Hence, for one thing, Kmart's in Alice Springs. That with 18 million people, it's very hard to generate an independent, vibrant culture. You can have pieces of it, but you can't have like a great film industry. You can't have a great music industry or even a great publishing industry. You can have some great books and some great movies, but a lot of it has to be imported.
Bill, you cover a lot of ground in the book, but in a way it reminded me of your book, A Walk in the Woods, in that there was so much ground to cover that you really couldn't cover it all, could you?
No, and that surprised me. I thought that coming from America, I understood large countries. And so I felt as when I was kind of roughing out a plan of attack for Australia, I was giving myself so much time to cover certain areas and measuring them out on maps. And it just turned out that it's somehow bigger than it looks. It's somehow bigger than it really is. A lot of it's to do with just this sheer emptiness, this just hypnotizing void out there, that there really is in large parts of the country nothing there. It takes a lot longer just to get from place to place, and then having got to the place, it takes longer to find stuff that's eventful enough that you'd want to put in a book. So I didn't cover as much of the country as I had intended to. There's still large parts of the country that I want personally, even if I never write about them, that I want personally to go back and see. The Northwest Corner, for instance, is an area of really quite incredible beauty in a very stark sort of way. And I didn't get within, 800 miles of there.
You did cover a lot of ground, and you did always manage to get from place to place without running out of gas. Your fascination with trivia is really impressive. You love stories of people that died in excruciating ways. You love stories about all the poisonous animals and insects, and I learned so much from reading this book. But you have just a fascination with this stuff, don't you?
Well, I do. I can't help it. I mean, I really do. And I think the thing about Australia is that, A, it is really, really interesting. I mean, much more interesting than most of us suppose. And B, it's kind of doubly interesting because most of us have never heard these stories. I mean, the stories of exploration of the interior of Australia are great, great stories because it is such a forbidding environment. And they're almost kind of in a sort of pathetic, poignant way. They're really quite comical usually, because what you had was these people from the British Isles that were the explorers. These are people from England and Ireland that have spent their whole lives in temperate climates, in small places. They have no sense of really harsh desert conditions, and they have no sense at all of really great expanses and what it is to try to cross them. And so you would get, throughout the 19th century, you would get these repeated expeditions into the interior where these people were trying to cross the country from one end to the other, setting off with totally inappropriate things, lacking things that they really should have had, and or taking things that are just, in retrospect, were just so ridiculous to take along with them. I mean, there was this one guy, Thomas Mitchell, an early explorer, who went on two very lengthy explorations of the interior, and he dragged a boat with him the whole way. He was so convinced that he was going to encounter an inland sea or at least some sort of water system like the Great Lakes that he dragged this boat everywhere and never until the very last gave up on this boat. And it's just, you just find that, people setting off with the most incredible things. And then they get out there, and they're totally out of their element, and they just start dropping like flies. And the interesting thing is that all the time that this was happening, on expedition after expedition, Aborigines would be standing on the neighboring hillside staring at these, these European fools who are dying out there. And it never did it occur to the Europeans to say to the Aborigines, excuse me, what are we doing wrong? Can you tell us how it is that you thrive in this barren wilderness? And, we've got horses, we've got provisions, we've got all these advantages, guns and everything that you don't have, and yet, we're dying and you're not. It never occurred to them to ask for advice and guidance, because they just looked on the Aborigines as you might look on it, kangaroo or some other animal. It's just part of the landscape, but not something that could actually to interact with.
And I'm sure the Aborigines walked up to that 1,400 pounds of sugar and just kind of looked puzzled. As you point out throughout the book, the Aborigines were the one point of Australia that was very difficult for you. It was difficult to get people to talk about it. They seemed to be invisible, and every time you'd bring it up, someone would go, "Oh, they're a terrible problem."
Yeah, it is a huge problem. I mean, all Australians recognize that on any level, any measure of social well-being, Aborigines always come bottom. Always, whether it's infant mortality rates or rates of imprisonment, general poverty, alcoholism, drug abuse, glue sniffing, you name some social indicator, and the Aborigines are bang on the bottom every single time. And all Australians recognize that this is a serious problem, and it is clearly Australia's greatest social failing. And it's a real problem because the Aborigines, it's very, very analogous in a lot of ways to the problem of Native Americans in America. Same sort of thing happened. You have these people that own the continent, and then outsiders come in and drive them increasingly into more and more marginal areas. But in Australia, it's like that times, you know, 10, because the marginal areas in Australia are seriously marginal. I mean, it's real desert. They're a long way from anywhere. And so you have these people who are a very small part of the overall Australian population. There are 1.5-2% or so of people there that live way out in the middle of nowhere. So there's, you know, really reduced educational opportunities, virtually negligible employment opportunities. It's a serious problem. How do you incorporate these people into mainstream society without destroying their culture at the same time? You know, how do you give them the benefits of being in an advanced Western nation without just, you know, destroying everything that is meaningful to them already? And it's a real problem. You know, nobody has come up with a solution yet. But it does seem that as if the parts of Western society that at which the Aborigines thrive are all the kind of unattractive features, like drinking and drugs and so on. I mean, that's a horribly sweeping generalization. There's lots of Aborigines that thrive in mainstream culture there. But by and large, you know, it's a pretty discouraging problem.
You are listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. And it's the best of the book nook. This morning we are revisiting an interview I recorded with Bill Bryson 17 years ago. He came out to Yellow Springs and joined us live in studio to talk about his Australia travel book, In a Sunburned Country. And during the interview, we also talked about the book that made him famous. It had come out right before this book, a book called A Walk in the Woods. And coming up in this next segment, I have a big surprise for Bill Bryson. It involves A Walk in the Woods and another interview that we had in the book nook when Bill Bryson was in Australia doing the research for In a Sunburned Country. I was interviewing somebody else about Bill Bryson. We'll bring you that segment right after this. You are listening to the best of the book nook on WYSO. Bill Bryson visited the studios at WYSO back in 2000, and we interviewed him for his book, In a Sunburned Country. And we are revisiting that interview this morning on the show. And Bill Bryson and I have some things in common. We're both from Des Moines, Iowa. Both of us grew up on the west side of Des Moines, Iowa. Both of us went to Roosevelt High School. Bill Bryson's older than me. I never knew him in high school or in Des Moines. In fact, the first time I met him in person was during this interview. But we do have a mutual friend, a friend who I'm still in touch with. In fact, I just got a text message from him the other day. During this segment of the interview, you're going to find out about our very special mutual friend. It's the best of the book nook. Bill, I'm amazed by your ability to talk about the big picture, to make these sweeping generalizations, and to see the big picture of Australian politics, of Australian weather, of Australian whatever. And then the next second, you're focusing on the most incredible minutiae. How do you make those transitions so smoothly?
Oh, I don't know. It's a very flatteringly phrased question. And I thank you for it. I don't know. I write about whatever I think is interesting. I mean, I take the view, you don't know what to put in a book. I mean, you don't know what to, there's so much. Something like Australia, it really is a lot richer than I'd expected it to be. There was a lot of stuff that just didn't get into the book. And so I just take the view that if it interests me, then with any luck, it will interest the reader. And part of the way of keeping something interesting is that you just, you know, you move around a lot. You keep the story moving. I know when I set off to write the book that there will come a point when I will talk about, say, kangaroos and marsupials and why there are marsupials in Australia and why they don't thrive elsewhere or something like that. And then there comes a point when you're actually writing the book that you think, well, now is that time. This is a place where I was actually looking for kangaroos, so it's a legitimate occasion to introduce this subject. And that's simply what you do when you write it. You just try to remember to cover as many things as you can.
Well, I find good humor to be so rare in the world of American letters these days. I mean, you've got T.C. Boyle, Bill Bryson, Garrison Keillor. There's so few of you out there that really write books that as you're reading them, you can't help but break out laughing because you have that turn of phrase, that funny story, that funny quote. And I often wonder, do you think it's funny when you write it?
Well, you wouldn't. Yeah, I mean, you have to be convinced that it has to amuse you. I mean, if you don't think it's funny, then you can't possibly put it in the book. And I do enjoy making jokes. I mean, and actually, talking in a more mechanical sense, that is a lot trickier. That part of sometimes I am. It is purely intended to be amusing and not taken seriously, and then a few pages later, suddenly you are talking about something like Aboriginal issues, where there are no jokes at all. I mean, there is just no scope for humor in something like that. This is very serious business, and sometimes it is more of a problem to keep things on an even keel so that the reader isn't too thrown out by the fact that you're having these fairly serious changes of pace. But, I mean, I'm aware that most people aren't interested in Australia, just not interested in Australia. And even if you could get them interested in Australia as a kind of theoretical undertaking, they're not interested in Aborigines or feral animals or the wildlife or plant life of the country. So you have to engage them in some way. And one of the ways I do that is by trying to make it funny.
It's very funny when you just talk about your encounters or your travels and you find someone who's exquisitely boring or terribly annoying. Your description of being in Canberra, is absolutely unbearable to read what a horrifying place this was. And then you reinforce that by talking to a woman who was from Canberra. And then when you run into Americans, so often they're ugly Americans.
They're not always... It's true. I'm guilty. Convict me. But it's not. You run into a lot of people on any undertaking who are not remotely offensive or ugly, but they don't get in the books because for that very reason they're totally innocuous. Not just Americans, but the Australians who are there or people you meet along the way, and it is a fact that the people who tend to end up in books, travel books. Generally, I think, are people who are in some way memorable or eccentric or ugly. So I do tend from time to time to latch onto those people. I did follow at least on one occasion at Ayers Rock an American couple that were not only ugly but seriously inconvenient to me at that particular moment because they were taking up my time and. And asking a lot of really dumb questions, and I just wanted them. It was one of those occasions when you just longed to have a ray gun, and you could just make these people, vaporize these people, just transplant them to somewhere else. I mean, I don't want them to stop existing, but you could just, make them vanish from here and be back in Cleveland or something.
Well, for those of us who have followed your career, we also see you in situations where, for instance, you ran into that elderly couple who you identified as being from Yorkshire from their accent, and you keep wondering, is Bill going to say something about Yorkshire to these people? And, of course, you never do, but they're incredibly funny, and they're so annoying.
they were sort of delightfully – I mean, because they didn't really impinge on my progress in any way. They weren't standing between me and a clerk that I wanted to talk to. So they were from my point of view, they were really good value. I mean, they were totally irrelevant to the whole book. They had nothing really to do with Australia at all. But I was just so taken. I mean, it's a very, very accurate representation of the experience I had at this lookout point with where I ran into this elderly couple. And they were just so sort of crazy and delightful. And the man was so outspoken and severe that I couldn't not put them in the book.
And your years in England have obviously stayed with you as you, at appropriate times, look for the local pub or hope that there's a good pub. And there were a couple of instances where you really got in your cups, particularly that last one where you found out the next day that you had arranged to swap your house with someone from Korea.
I didn't know whether it was North Korea or South. Yes, we did. It was, well, you see, but you've got to bear in mind, Vic, that especially when you're in the outback, there is nothing. I mean, your options for the evening are to sit in a motel room and watch television or to go to the pub. And, you know, what are you going to do? There is nothing else. Or you could go for a little walk, I suppose. But, and I used to do that kind of combination of those two things. I would eat, go for a walk, and then go to the pub. And because there was nothing else to do. And also, of course, you know, pubs tend to be terribly productive in terms of material for a book. It's, if anything is going on in the town or the dusty little station that you happen to be on, then the pub is where you're going to find it. And I do like a beer. I mean, can't deny that. So it suited my purposes in every way to go to these places.
Why do they call this bitter? It's not bitter. I loved your send-up of the cricket matches on the radio.
Oh, I'm so pleased you enjoyed that. Because, you know, I mean, I lived in England for 20 years and had to listen to and have cricket as part of the background, the kind of wallpaper of life. And I never understood what was going on. There is no, it seems to me, no possibility for an American to ever get into cricket. If you come from anywhere in the world where there's are more exciting sports, there's no way that you're ever going to love cricket. And so I had an occasion finally to do a little parody of what it is to listen to a cricket match on the radio, because that's all I could get on the car radio as I was driving into these increasingly remote places. So I did have a little fun with making what it sounds like to an American or to an unacquainted person to listen to the description of a cricket match.
Well, it's a very funny book, and I enjoyed your solitary journey. But when you hook up with this friend for a while, that's some very funny stuff, because then you get into conversations with this guy, long-term conversations.
With Alan Sherwin, the guy from England. Yeah, I mean, it was a great gift to me that he insisted on coming. I mean, he really was convinced that I was going to come a cropper somewhere out in the outback. So he wanted to come and look after me in the most dangerous parts of the trip. And it turned out to be, we sort of ended up arguing and squabbling like an old married couple a lot of the time. And he provided good value and also companionship. I mean, he was with me when I was driving across some of the most empty and arid parts of the country. So I'm grateful to him at two levels. One, you know, just personally, because he gave me companionship. And secondly, because he provided material for the book.
I know many of you have read Bill's book, A Walk in the Woods. Bill, when you wrote that book, did you expect it to be so successful?
No. No. The only time I ever expected a book to be successful was The Lost Continent. And the reason I expected that was because after the book was published, an editor from Harper and Row, as it then was, they paid a lot of money for the American rights to the book. It had already been published in Britain. And they phoned me up and said, we're giving you all this money. We're going to fly you to America. We're going to send you for media training for a week, and then we're going to send you out on a book tour. And we're going to make you famous. This book is going to be a huge success in America. So I did all these things, went to media training, started off on the book tour. The book was a total flop. Reviewers everywhere hated that book. So in the Midwest, oddly enough, the part of the country that I was sort of most merciless about in my jokes, it tended to get quite good reviews in places like Minneapolis and Chicago and so on.
That's because they got it.
They got it. And Midwesterners can laugh at themselves. And they recognize that I was actually, that there was a real genuine affection attached to this. I was making fun of what it is to grow up in Iowa and how you ache to get out of there and why you find it really dreary and boring. And some of it was kind of acidic, I grant you, but it was mostly, I mean, I'm proud to be from Iowa. I'm proud to be a Midwesterner. And I think most Midwesterners recognize that. And people on the coasts were outraged that I was, you know, making fun of part of the country that they themselves would never dream of living in. I mean, it seemed so kind of hypocritical. Anyway, the book was a great flop. And that was a real learning experience for me, because I had assumed that the publishers, having spent a lot of money on buying the rights to the book and having told me that it was going to be a huge success, that they knew what they were talking about. Turns out, of course, that nobody ever knows anything like that. So every subsequent book, I've never expected very much from. And in that sense, I've seldom been disappointed. and then A Walk in the Woods comes along, and I expected more or less the same kind of thing. Not many. Who wants to read about a hike on the Appalachian Trail? You know, I didn't really expect it to catch on in any kind of big way. And it did. It just, for some reason, you know, there's so much luck involved. Just being, having the right book that's there at the right moment that kind of catches people when they're ready for that kind of a book. And that, I was lucky. It happened with that book. And it you know, got good reviews and sold very well. And it keeps on selling. And it makes a huge difference to you as a writer. It makes it a lot easier to then go on to do other things that you might want to do.
And it's still a bestseller in paperback, isn't it?
So it is, yeah.
How many printings has it been through?
Oh, I don't know. The last time I saw it, I looked in the New York Times Book Review, I think it was up to about 68 weeks in paperback on the bestseller list, which is, you know, I mean, there's even for a known author, you can't forecast that sort of thing. I mean, even Stephen King can't count on. So, it is very lucky. It's an experience that will never be repeated, almost certainly.
Well, I think you've crossed the border. I think you're a known author now, Bill.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. It certainly helped. I mean, it raised my profile a lot. And it's obviously very gratifying in all kinds of ways.
I think that book was magical in a lot of ways. The relationship between you and Stephen Katz along the trail is just hysterical. And I mean, it was just a magic thing.
Well, thank you. I mean, what a nice thing to say. I can't tell you how indebted I am to him. I mean, I'm just, and he's still, you know, my best friend. I mean, he's still such a good pal. He was so sporting about the whole thing, both in the sense of coming along with me and sticking by me. He had no reason to be out there. He, you know, there were times I was just certain he was going to tell me that he was quitting. He couldn't take it anymore. And I couldn't have blamed him for a moment. It would have totally destroyed the book. You know, you can't introduce a character and then, you know, you walk with him for four chapters and then he's gone. I would have had to abandon the whole project. But never once, whatever he was thinking privately, never once did he say to me, you know, this is crazy. I'm out of here. You know, goodbye. Good luck. You know, it's been a slice. And he didn't do that. He stood by me. And then when I wrote about him as I did in the book, which was sometimes a very hard thing to do, because I am crazy about him. I mean, he's a really great guy, but he's also a very difficult, sort of larger-than-life Falstaffian sort of guy who is high maintenance. I mean, everybody who knows him will agree with that, and just does crazy, foolish things a lot of the time, which he recognizes himself. But it was still, you know, I mean, I felt as if I were sort of exposing his soft underbelly at times for comic effect. And he was just such a good sport about it. He loves the book, and he loves all the attention that it's brought to him. And one of the most wonderful aspects of it is that he's become, unexpectedly, become something of an inspiration for recovering alcoholics in a lot of places. When I do readings, I'm told this so many times, which I then report to him, and he's really touched by that he feels that you know, there's a certain importantness to him that he wouldn't have achieved otherwise.
My guest is Bill Bryson. Bill, when A Walk in the Woods came out in hardback, I called your publicist at Broadway and I said, you know, I'd love to have Bill Bryson, even if it's just a phoner about this book. I'm so in love with this book. And your publicist said, no, I think he's in Australia. You know, he's not available to do an interview, blah, blah, blah. So finally, I got totally desperate and I decided I'm going to do the next best thing, and I got an interview with Stephen Katz.
And here, you did Stephen Katz.
Here's an excerpt.
That's where it came from.
Yes, I'm kind of a unique individual, aren't I?
Now, you know, Stephen, I'm sure there's a lot of things that he did not put in the book that you thought were interesting or funny or belonged in the book. What are some of those things that did not get in the book?
These are good. That's a tough one. There are a lot of instances where it was so daunting that it turned into be humorous. You know, just walking, sludging along in the rain, hour after hour. And one of my most memorable things is when I caught up to Billy, and on the top of a hill or a knob, as they call them. And he's overlooking this panoramic view, and I must have been close on his heels because he hadn't quite caught his breath and even hadn't taken his pack off yet. usually by the time I catch up with him, he's got his pack off and his shoes untied and he's got a smoke in his pipe and everything, letting me know that he's been there for a long time waiting for me. But on this occasion, he hadn't done any of that, and he was just looking at the beautiful panorama. And I came up behind him, and I said something about, this is a beautiful view. And he goes, yeah, it is. But, you know, my publisher would have paid for me to write a travel book about Hawaii, about Fiji, about any of these wonderful places in the world. And me, like an idiot, picked the Appalachian Trail.
Stephen Katz.
That's all come back to me now. He sent me edited extracts of that interview, in which he would just put in the tiniest snatches of your conversation with him, and then like about 11 minutes of reggae music,
uh-huh.
And then we'd go back to the interview. So I've only heard it in edited parts, but I'd forgotten that was you. I mean, I hadn't made the connection. He's an amazing guy. I mean, he really is one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met.
Well, if I hadn't grown up in Des Moines, I would never know where to find a guy like Stephen Katz. But
it's just so nice for me that it's confirmed that he exists. The number of times that people say to me, did you make him up? Like, I went out and walked the trail on my own and didn't, you know, just had this fantasy character. So it's at least here in Ohio, it can be proved that he's a real person.
Now, you guys go back quite a ways. Didn't he once throw you through a plate glass window in Turkey?
He did, yes. He did. We go back to seventh grade. That's when we met in junior high school in Des Moines. And just became really good friends right away. We traveled around Europe together, which became the basis for a book called Neither Here Nor There, in which it has to be said, the Stephen Katz character in that book is really much more fictionalized. I mean, I just made him into a kind of comic book, one-dimensional character. Essentially, I took all our most unattractive qualities and loaded them onto him. But on that trip, an anecdote that doesn't appear in the book, but it's very true, is that we were in Istanbul walking around, very, very drunk one night, as we were most nights.
Rocky,
Turkish mm-hmm. Rocky, we'd been drinking in And for some reason, in a moment of kind of affection, he embraced me. It totally startled me. I mean, I had some normal behavior on his part. And picked me up and threw me into a plate glass window, which came shattering down all around me. And, you know, how I avoided being decapitated, I don't know. All it did was it just nicked my shoulder as it went past. And it bled quite heavily. I mean, it looked pretty good, made a nice photograph, but in fact it was a very superficial wound, and then we spent this long night. He was immediately arrested.
Wasn't Turkey under martial law at the time?
Effectively, yeah. And from out of nowhere, this was late at night, walking down this dark street, and from out of nowhere all these people emerged and just clamped their hands around him and made a citizen's arrest. And then we just had this very bizarre night, which was spent first in a hospital where my wound was not stitched, it was stapled. This guy got some kind of a staple gun, not unlike the sort of thing you attach tiles to a ceiling with, and stapled my shoulder back together. And fortunately, I was so anesthetized with intoxicants that I didn't feel a thing. And then we spent the rest of the night in a police station where I was being assured by all these people that he would be going to prison the next day. This was back in the days of Midnight Express, you uh-huh. know, where you... If you went to a Turkish prison, you didn't, you know, it wasn't a happy experience. And
I'm sure it still isn't.
No, I'm sure it still isn't. Anyway, it was, we had to go to court the next morning. And by which time, of course, he had no recollection of this incident at all. And we go to the court, and he goes in before this Turkish judge. And the Turkish judge is very severe and is about to send him away for at least some kind of a period of incarceration and asks him why and Katz, his real name is actually Matt, apologizes to the judge for his despicable behavior and says that he had drunk too much Turkish Rocky. And the judge looks at him and sort of his face lights up. And he's so pleased that we've been drinking their national drink. And he understood completely. This can happen to anybody. Drink Rocky? Of course. Things will happen. It's okay. So he just made us pay for the window. It was like, $28 or something. And sort of waggled his finger and said, to, you know, you boys behave yourselves now, which I can assure you we did after that, and let us go. So he didn't have to go to prison, and it had a happy ending.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was one of my favorite interview segments, because in that segment, I was able to surprise Bill Bryson. I had my cassette queued up of my interview with Stephen Katz, his hiking companion on the Appalachian Trail during a walk in the woods, and he didn't expect it. He had no clue. I interviewed him back in the 1990s. It was a phone interview. He's probably done thousands of interviews over the last 25 years. He didn't remember that I'd interviewed him before. He didn't remember me. He didn't remember that I'm from Des Moines, too. And what a surprise it was to be able to pull out that cassette of Stephen Katz talking about his perspective on a walk in the woods. It's the Best of the Book Nook. We'll bring you one more segment from my 2000 interview with Bill Bryson right after this. Our final segment of the Best of the Book Nook with Bill Bryson continues on WYSO. My guest is Bill Bryson. Bill, on this program, we try to ask the questions that you don't get asked in all those other boring routine interviews, and I'm sure you don't get asked about that very often, and you probably haven't.
It's the first time ever.
Yeah, you probably also haven't been asked, did you and Matthew have fun in Cuba?
Oh, that's, I'm so pleased. Did he tell you we were going?
No, I just have, I have good.
What's the sources? You're not the man in the old Ford Fairlane that drives around very slowly behind me wherever
with the
I
beard
go.
And the cigar. Yeah.
No, we went to when we were on the Appalachian Trail, we were talking a lot, as you do, and one of the things it turned out to Matt, I should call him Katz for the sake of his cover, but it turned out that he always wanted to go to Cuba. And it also turned out that I had been to Cuba for a magazine assignment, and so I was able to tell him it's just the most terrific country. I mean, wonderful people. It's very, very interesting for, you know, all the obvious reasons, and you have this real profound sense when you're there that it's all going to change. I mean, old Fidel is now, you know, well into his 70s. He's clearly not going to last forever, and you have this sense that once he goes, everything is going to change very swiftly. Presumably all the Miami Cubans will flood back in, and the next thing you know, it'll be like a little outpost of Miami in the Caribbean. So the sense of being, when you're there, of being in a really kind of exotic and special place. And I said to him, I'll take you one day, I promise, I'll take you one day. Well, after the book came out and had done so well, I really felt like I owed him. I really am deeply indebted to him. So part of his reward for having been so much the scapegoat in this book was that last spring I took him to Havana, and we had a week there, and we just had a great time. He loved it. It is a fabulous country. I mean, they're just, you know, whatever you think about it politically, they're wonderful people. They're terrific people. And it's such an interesting place because, you know, you've never been to any place like it. This is a place that where, you know, McDonald's and Pizza Huts and so on are unknown. It is really a perfect, crumbling, but perfect 19th century city. It hasn't got all of those things, just the gas stations and shopping malls and strip malls and all those things.
No Kmart,
but nothing. I mean, not even a hint of anything like that. It's just the world as it was, certainly in 1944 or whatever, you know.
1958, your favorite year.
1958 would be a good year. But before there's even, you know, before there even existed a Holiday Inn or uh-huh. anything, those things haven't even remotely intruded onto it. So it's just fascinating. I mean, just as a thing to gaze upon, it's quite wonderful. But even there, I remember to get there, we had to fly from Toronto because, of course, there are no direct flights from the States. And I flew in from Boston to Toronto, and he flew from Chicago, Des Moines to Chicago to Toronto. We met in Toronto late at night. We were going to stay overnight at an airport hotel and then continue on the next morning very early. So we go to this – we meet up and go and split up at the hotel, go off to our rooms, and meet up again like at 5 a.m. the next morning. And this is just so Katz. He's carrying a bag with that's heavy and that he didn't have the night before. I said, what do you got in there? And he said, didn't you see all that stuff? I said, what's that? He says, yeah, potato chips and candy bars. There was a whole jar of almonds.
And ho-hos.
And I said, that's the mini bar. He said, is it? He had no concept of, he thought it was just stuff that the hotel had left.
So you got charged for it.
Well, I said, you know, that's going to all be on my credit card. And he was appalled. He said, what'd they put? You mean they've just put all this stuff there to tempt me, and then they want me to pay for it? It's so unfair. He was really outraged. But that's just so completely him, you know. And we ended up – and as it turned out, you know, stuff like that, snack food, is very welcome in Havana because it's not necessarily an easy place to eat. So we ate it all. But it was – you know, it all turned up extra, you know, $53 or something on my bill when the Visa card came in.
Well, I just had a funny thought when you mentioned how when Fidel dies, the Cubans from Miami are going to go back to Miami or go back to Cuba. And I just thought for a minute, you know, if he died a couple of years ago and we'd had that exodus, we wouldn't be doing a recount in Florida today.
That's a very valid point. Yes, I hadn't thought of that, but it's certainly true. I mean, you do really feel when you're there. It's clearly it's unsustainable that they're living on. Not in the real world any longer, that you know, communism has stopped all over the world. This is just this sort of little outpost that is just doesn't, you know, it didn't seem so ridiculous 20 years ago when there was communism all over the place. Now it's just, you know, it's this sort of pointless exercise in a particular form of government that is not sustainable in the long run. And people naturally want all those things. I mean, there's just pent up consumer demand there, like you wouldn't believe, quite, you know, naturally. And I fear what's going to happen is that, you know, Fidel will go, all communism will be just swept away, and they'll probably lose a lot of good things as well as the bad side of things. I mean, they have first rate health care and things like that that you have to admire. Those things will be imperiled. But what will particularly be distressing, I think, is that, you know, rather than go in and restore and save all these old buildings, and it really has the potential to be the most beautiful city in the Western Hemisphere, they'll just get swept away. You know, they'll say, people from the Marriott Corporation or whatever will say, this isn't worth, you know, it's going to cost us a bundle to fix this up. Let's just raise it, and we'll put up a new nice steel and glass structure. And besides, you know, we can make it 38 stories high, and people will be able to see all the way to Florida from the top floor, and, you know, it'll be great.
And we can have McDonald's in the lobby.
We'll have McDonald's and, mm-hmm. you know, Body Shop and all that stuff. And I fear that's what's going to happen. I mean, it's just the way of the world. But it would be great to think that somehow, you know, somebody would stop them from doing that. Because it's, I mean, the potential to salvage the city is enormous. It would take huge investment. And I'm probably not being remotely practical. Uh-huh. But if you saw it, you'd realize this is worth keeping.
I'm a big fan, Bill, and it's not just because I'm from Des Moines. And it was great. You talked about those old buildings in Havana. I got a flash of some old buildings from your book. You talk about going to see those Jeff Chandler movies with your mom at the old RKO Orpheum.
And yes.
I remember that theater district we had. We had the RKO Orpheum, and was it the Paramount across the street? And right down the corner, it was the Des Moines Theater.
That's right, yeah.
All those theaters are gone.
They're all gone. Well, as they are in most places. And I think it's a great pity. I mean, my kids... You know, we brought them back to America 5 years ago, and part of the reason was so that I could show them America. But one thing I can't show them is great old movie theaters. They don't exist anymore. I mean, where we live in New Hampshire, when I take them to the movies, we go to a mall to begin with, and then they go and sit in a room that's not much bigger than your living room at home, and you watch a movie on what looks like a bath towel. I mean, the screen is so small as to be ridiculous. And, you know, where is the magic in that? You need – the screen has got to be 40 feet wide and 20 feet high, and you've got to be there with 3,000 people. And, you know, it's just got to be a kind of wraparound experience. And it isn't anymore, and I think that's such a loss.
Well, they vanished with the afternoon newspapers.
They did indeed, yeah.
Well, Bill, it's really a treat to have you in person in studio.
It's great to be here. It's wonderful to be back. Thank you very much.
My guest has been Bill Bryson, and his book is In a Sunburned Country. What's the next book that we can expect from you?
Well, I'm told my wife, I promised her I wouldn't do a travel book. So I'd stay at home for a while. So the idea that I'm kind of working on, I haven't really refined it yet, but is to do a sort of biography of planet Earth, to popular history stroke popular science type book, where I try to just look at how the Earth operates, why it is where it is and has life on it, and how it was formed, and how it operates and functions, and just things like why the oceans are salty and the Great Lakes aren't, and just sort of basic look at Earth and how it and its systems, and try to make it interesting, engaging in some way.
Wow.
A lot of trivia.
That reminds me of you trying to sell that woman on how interesting those fossils were in the book. You know, that part at the very end of the book.
Oh, yeah, the stromatolites. Yes, it wasn't one of my more successful public relations exercises on behalf of fossils. But they are interesting.
Uh-huh.
They are interesting in theory rather than actually as physical presences.
Well, thanks, Bill.
Thank you very much, Vic. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, an interview I recorded 17 years ago with Bill Bryson. He still lives in England. He's still writing. It's been a couple years since he put out The Road to Little Dribbling, another travel book. He visited us in Yellow Springs back in 2000 to talk about his Australian travel book, In a Sunburned Country. Thanks for listening to the Best of the Book Nook. Stay tuned to WYSO.